So welcome to this episode of Chats with Gigi. I'm very excited because joining me today is Dan Harris. He is the co-anchor for ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America. He is also the author of 10% Happier, a number one New York Times bestseller. Now, you're promoting a new book called 10% Happier, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics that I absolutely love. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
It is my pleasure to have you here. Let's do a little brief rundown of what we've got going on with this book. So in your first book, 10% Happier, and now in this publication, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, you share that the trigger that led you to the discovery, I guess, of meditation and eventually advocating in its favor, so to speak, all over the place, was a panic attack you had on live television in front of something like 5 million viewers, right? Take us back to that day.
Yeah, sure. This is back in 2004, and I was anchoring the news updates. They used to have a position on the morning shows where somebody comes on at the top of each hour and delivers the headlines. And I was filling in that day, but I had actually done this job many, many times before. And so I didn't have any reason to foresee what was about to happen, which is that I was overtaken by this big bolt of fear right as I started, you know, reading the stories off of the teleprompter. And my heart started racing, my mouth dried up, my palms were sweating, my mind was out of control, my lungs seized up. I literally couldn't talk.
Wow.
And I had to quit right in the middle and toss it back to the main anchors of the show.
Now, there's a whole lapse of time that happens between that moment and you writing these books and making meditation a part of your life. But just to be clear, it doesn't need to necessarily get to a panic attack for the rest of us to discover and benefit from meditation. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, you don't need to be an idiot because I was. I mean, I think it's useful to have a bottom, like to hit a rock, as they say in recovery circle, to hit a rock bottom. It can be mm-hmm. very useful, but do you find that you're distracted too often? Do you find that you eat when you're not hungry? Do you find that you sometimes lose your temper when it doesn't make any sense?
Yeah, well, all of the above.
That's all. Yes, of course, we all do. That's all just being part of being human. And meditation is just a simple, secular, scientifically validated way to be less prone to do those things.
And now, before you got into meditation, you were an absolute skeptic. You really visualized, like many of us do, that meditation was walking around barefoot in a toga, pretty much. Tell me about the transition from being a complete skeptic to discovering the science and the benefits behind meditation and the point where you're at right now advocating for it in your books.
It was really, about seeing that there was all of this science that really looks at the impact of meditation on the brain and on the rest of the body. And, you know, I'm not a scientist myself. My parents are scientists. My wife is a scientist. I was not good at math, so was never attempted to be a scientist. But I take it seriously, and I was really intrigued, and I wanted the benefits for myself. The lower blood pressure, boosted immune system, literally rewiring key parts of the brain that have to do with focus and stress and self-awareness. And also where the science is really the strongest is that meditation has been shown to be good for anxiety and depression, both of which I've dealt with, you know, my whole life.
I very much enjoyed your first book, 10% Happier. It was a ton of fun to read. Now your second book, 10% Happier, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, is more like a manual, but would you say you need to read one before the other, or you can just jump right into the second one?
You could totally jump right into the second one. Somebody once described, and I like this, I wouldn't have been able to come up with this on my own, but the second one is a how-to, the first one is a why-to.
I like that.
The first book, 10% Happier, is a memoir, although it's really an argument dressed up as a memoir. The argument is, you know, you should meditate, and I make that argument by telling you my story. The second one is designed, the second book, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, is designed to make up for a flaw in the first one, which is that I didn't do enough, I don't think, to help people actually adopt this practice. There are so many misconceptions and myths that stand in the way of adopting this simple habit, fearing that you don't have enough time, or fearing that it's somehow self-indulgent, or that you might lose your edge if you do it. And so I wanted to do a book that systematically classified and tackled all of these obstacles.
What would you say to someone who is still skeptical right now about meditation and that thought that always crosses our minds about, well, I can't sit there and quiet my thoughts. There's no way everything going on in my brain right now is just going to turn off. What would you say to those people?
The idea that you have to turn everything off is, I think, one of the most damaging myths about meditation. It is impossible to stop thinking. As I like to tell people, if you sit to meditate and you find yourself all of a sudden in this thought-free, bliss bubble, you're either enlightened or you're dead. The goal of meditation is not to turn off all of your thoughts. It's just to have a different relationship to your thoughts. So it might be useful for me to very briefly explain how you meditate.
Absolutely.
When I talk about meditation, I'm talking about something called mindfulness meditation, which is very simple, very secular. And it really just involves sitting in a reasonably quiet place, closing your eyes, and then trying to bring your full attention to the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. You just pick a spot like your nose or your chest or your belly. You're just doing this seemingly easy thing of just trying to feel your breath coming in and going out. And then what you'll notice as soon as you try to do this is that you're going to be distracted over and over and over and over again. And a lot of people, when they get distracted, they think that, oh, I'm a failure at meditation. But actually, this is not a failure. This is a victory. Seeing that you've become distracted is a victory of real consequence, because when you see how crazy you are, how quick your mind moves, how negative and self-referential your thinking process is, then you are less likely to be owned by it. So what this is like a bicep curl for your brain over and over and over again, seeing how nutty you are, letting it go, returning your focus to your breath, and then getting distracted and starting again and again and again. This is what literally changes your brain.
One of the things I loved right when I opened your book is you have a quote right in the front that says, "The untrained mind is stupid," by a meditation master. I'm sure I'm going to butcher his name. Ajahn Chah, is that right?
Ajahn Chah, yeah, you were pretty close.
Thank you. Now, I know there's a lot of people out there that'll probably get defensive about that statement because they think they've got their minds under control. Is every mind that doesn't meditate untrained?
Well, I mean, I put the quote there as a little bit of a kind of with my tongue in my cheek, and I think it was said that way too a little bit. I mean, the idea is that let me just speak for myself. My mind, when it was untrained, was very stupid, and that doesn't mean that I lacked any intellectual capacity. It means I lacked emotional intelligence. When you are unself-aware, when you don't see that your mind is filled with these urges and impulses and emotional storms and random thoughts, all of that stuff owns you. You just act it all out blindly. When mindfulness just brings all of this into your field of attention, makes you aware that you're having this nonstop conversation with yourself, so that these thoughts that are flitting through the windshield of your mind aren't little dictators that get you to do stupid things without any self-reflection. And so in that sense, you become less stupid.
Dan, you suffered from depression long before you wrote these books, and you didn't even know that the symptoms you were experiencing, the crankiness, the exhaustion, were indeed depression. We ignore warning signs like that so often, and there are so many triggers to depression. I mean, it's not always necessarily a gloomy moment or a bad memory. Sometimes things that are viewed as positive can be a trigger to our depression. And it all kind of revolves around a very interesting word that I learned through you called prapancha. Can you explain that term to us, please? Because there's no way I could explain it as well as you do.
Okay. Well, I'll start with the second one. Prapancha is an ancient word from the Indian subcontinent. And the best way to understand it is, think about how like something will happen to you right now. Like you'll stub your toe or you will get a piece of bad news. And then all of a sudden you'll make this movie in your mind of like, why am I always the one who stubs his or her toe? This injury is never going to heal. I'm not going to be able to go to work tomorrow. I'm going to live under a bridge. Or you get a piece of bad news about like, maybe a competitor of yours gets a project that you have been angling for. And you think, I never get the good projects. I'm never going to get a good project. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get fired and I'm going to live under a bridge. And it all happens so quickly. We make these movies, these sort of fantastic phantasmagoric projections into the future, all because of a data point in the present moment, which may or may not mean anything like the movie that you are making in your mind. So propuncia is the word that describes this process, and it literally means the imperialistic tendency of mind. Like something happens right now, and we don't like it, and we create this whole, we colonize the future with this negative view based on this extrapolation from one data point. So, you know, that is actually the kind of, could be a working description of anxiety. Anxiety is fretful thinking about the future. Depression is often described as fretful thinking about the past. And we, you know, there's a lot more, of course, to both of those. But, you know, I think we can miss the signs of these. And I think one big reason why we can miss the signs, to go to the first part of your question of anxiety, depression, is that there's a stigma, an unnecessary and unhealthy stigma in our society around mental health issues. And I think slowly but surely, the more people who come out and talk about this stuff, the more the stigma will be reduced and the more people will feel comfortable talking about it to their loved ones, to their friends, so that they can get help when they need it.
Dan, while you were covering wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, you witnessed some pretty terrible stuff. You experienced dangers that most of us will never experience at all. And you said that you don't feel traumatized by any of that stuff. You don't feel like it affected you, mainly because you had to create a distance, emotional or psychological, so to speak, from those moments to allow you to do your job as a reporter. And in your case, you weren't traumatized, but would you say that maybe some of us create that same sort of distance from our own horrible scenes in our lives? Obviously, our scenes aren't to the extent of seeing dead bodies and explosions, such as what you experienced when you were covering wars abroad. But we do have a pretty horrible things that we go through in our own lives. And we do kind of make that distance in an attempt to function through them. Are we actually repressing our emotions and causing a deeper effect of that trauma to ourselves by doing this?
Absolutely. Look, we all live with trauma, whether we have what, you know, is sort of classically referred to as trauma or not. You know, when we talk about trauma now, we mean maybe somebody who's been in a war zone, mm-hmm, or had a bad car accident or was abused as a child or something like that. But living in a world, as we do, with non-negotiable facts such as impermanence, meaning that we are all subject to aging, illness, and death, and as is everybody we know, living in a world like that means trauma is part of the bargain. We don't like to talk about these things. It's considered morose or morbid or unpleasant to talk about these things, but it is, the, as I said before, the non-negotiable facts of, these are the non-negotiable facts of our lives. And so what I like about meditation is, instead of running away from our difficult emotions, from the difficult realities of living in this universe, we turn into them. We turn in, you know, you use meditation to take a closer look at what you're thinking and feeling so that it doesn't carry you away. Because the fact of the matter is, you may not want to take a look at your difficult emotions, but mm-hmm, they're there. And when they're unseen, they're controlling you. They're driving you blindly. So while it can be unpleasant to sit and be with yourself, I think it is really the only sane option when you think about it.
I want to get into that a little bit more because I know you've previously mentioned something that I found completely interesting. And that is that you've learned through meditation or about meditation that we don't really know where our thoughts and our feelings come from, right? But yet we hold ourselves responsible for them. We sort of let our thoughts and our feelings, I guess, create some sort of identity around those feelings, and we shouldn't. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Maybe you're spending time with your in-laws and you're finding yourself getting very impatient, or you're getting impatient with your kid. I think the temptation for us when we have these thoughts that maybe we're a little ashamed of is to tell ourselves a whole story about how we're terrible people. Mm-hmm. But the fact of the matter is, we don't know where our thoughts and emotions come from. We didn't invite them. You can't summon your emotions. I mean, you can on some level, but most of the time they're coming out of a mysterious void. You know, this is the mystery of consciousness. We literally don't know. If you go and close your eyes and look for the inner you that is doing all the thinking, you won't be able to find it. So there, it makes no sense to latch on to whatever uninvited emotion is happening right now for you, and tell yourself a whole negative story about what a terrible person you are. You can't control what you feel. What you can control is how you respond to it. And that is really the thing. So it's, you know, I might find I have a 3-year-old. I might find yesterday he was doing a lot of crying, and I had lots of uninvited thoughts of like, this is terrible. I want to like lock him in a closet or whatever, but I didn't act on them, nor did I tell myself a big story about what a terrible person I am. You can just let them come and go. And that to me is really for me personally, one of the big benefits of meditation.
Now, going back to your story about, you know, your discovery of meditation, it was years after your panic attack that you considered meditation to be something, you know, that maybe you might want to try. You did a lot of research. You read a book that you mentioned in your first book called A New Earth by Eckhart Tolle, which I've read myself, and I had very similar feelings to those that you shared in your book. I sort of loved the book, then hated the book, almost hated myself a little bit while I read the book. Talk to me about your experience with Eckhart Tolle and what happened after that.
Yeah, I mean, the book is frustrating. The book is both brilliant and frustrating. It's brilliant mm-hmm. in that it's a great description of our ego, our thinking mind, you know, the fact that we are having this nonstop conversation with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be a very compelling. Eckhart Tolle was literally the first person I ever heard point that out, which mm-hmm. it's like a thunderously obvious thing that we have a mind and our thinking. But nobody had ever said it so explicitly to me. The problem I found in the book is that, well, there are several. One is that it's kind of written in a very otherworldly, syrupy style that I find kind of annoying. And it's also filled with pseudoscientific claims, like talks about vibrational fields and all this other stuff. And it's, you know, the biggest problem is that while he accurately diagnoses the problem, you know, that we have this nonstop, chattering mind, he doesn't really tell you what to do about it. And that was, at least from what I could tell, he didn't have any actionable, practical advice. And so when I went and interviewed him and asked him, hey, dude, what do you do about the voice in the head? I was disappointed that he didn't seem able to give me any advice that made any sense to me.
And that sort of led you to discover meditation to be the answer to maybe not quiet, but sort of tame your mind, right?
Yeah, the best way to, you know, sort of surf your inner chaos rather than drown in it is meditation. And from what, in my experience, you know, it made sense to me. There were signs to support it. I tried it myself, mm-hmm. which I think fundamental, because basically if you haven't tried meditation, this conversation would be like listening to two people discuss chocolate that you've never tasted. So it's going to be super theoretical to people, unless you just do it.
So you've described your first experiences with meditation as similar to holding a live fish in your hand. And you said that since then, you've gone from meditating for 5 minutes, right, where you initially felt like you pretty much sucked at the whole thing, and then now you're working on meditating for 2 hours a day. What have you noticed within yourself and in your life and in your path from then to now all around?
Well, let me just say, I sometimes hesitate to mention to people that I meditate as much as I do, because I feel like people are going to conclude, A, that I'm crazy, or B, that you know, meditation is going to involve, necessitates setting aside huge chunks of time to do it. The good news is that, 5 to 10 minutes a day is a great meditation habit. And the even better news is that I honestly believe that if you did 1 minute on both days, you would get a lot of the benefits that we're discussing. The reason why I've upped my personal dosage is that I've taken a real interest in it. I've written a couple of books about it, and, I plan to write many more, and I take it very seriously, and I want to have as much experience as possible so that when I'm on the phone with somebody like you and you're asking questions, that I can give you real answers. But another reason why I continue to do it is, I mean, if you think about it, the whole idea of 10% happier is kind of a joke, but setting aside the sort of irreverent nature of the claim, if it's possible to get 10% happier, in other words, if you can train your mind to be a little more easygoing, as I believe meditation helps you do. What's the ceiling? You know, how far can you take it? And I'm just very curious about how far you can take it. And I just noticed for me that the more I engage in this practice, the less yanked around I am by my emotions. And that when good things happen for me, you know, like we had a baby 3 years ago, as I mentioned, that, you know, I've been able to, I'm much more sort of present and focused on being with this child, which is such a gift after we had a big infertility struggle. And then when bad things happen, when I'm having trouble at work, or, you know, there's a quarrel with my wife, I'm less prone to sort of drowning in the stress or the anger. And so I just find myself wanting to train my mental muscles in this way. And that's why I went to 2 hours, but that doesn't mean that everybody has to do that.
And you don't, and they're not, also for the record, they're not necessarily 2 consecutive hours. It's just to get the times in there whenever you get a chance, right?
Yes, that's a very important point. The way I was able to get to 2 hours was that I have a rule, which is I can do as many intervals, as many sort of sits, or, you know, that's what we call meditation, as many sessions as I want, whenever I want, and wherever I want. So I'll do it in the backseat of taxis, I'll do it on airplanes, in my office, in my apartment when my kid's not having a temper tantrum. And I just aim to get to 2 hours by the end of the day.
And now in this new book, you and your team pretty much jumped on a tour bus, right? That once belonged to, was it a Parliament Funkadelic, that group? You guys covered 18 yep. states in 11 days just talking about meditation. What did you encounter?
So we went out. I wanted to write a book about, you know, teaching people how to meditate and helping them get over the various obstacles.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't want it to be boring. I wanted it to have a story, because there are plenty of meditation books out, how to meditate books out there. And I wanted to write something that would really be kind of a page turner. So we decided to structure it as a road trip. So we got this big, stupid orange bus that was, as you said, previously occupied by Parliament Funkadelic. And we went across the country and we met all sorts of people, you know, cops, social workers, celebrities, politicians, and found out what was stopping them from meditating. And we helped them get over the hump. And I turned my co-authors and I turned this road trip into a book that is part narrative and part how to.
Well, I think you definitely succeeded at making it a page turner for sure, because I loved it. Failing at meditation, which has happened to so many of us that have tried meditating, it can be especially frustrating for beginners. But there's one thing in your book that you mentioned with one of your co-writers, Jeff. He says meditation should be friendly, right? Can you expand on that just a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, look, it goes back to what I was saying before about how people, you know, tell themselves these stories that, you know, when, as soon as you notice you've gotten distracted, you tell yourself this story of like, oh, well, I'm a failed meditator, I can't meditate. But it's, you know, my mission is to reframe that moment into a victory. And also, I think the other thing to keep in mind, Jeff, my co-author, is brilliant at this, is to just see how we engage in these moments when we notice we've become distracted at meditation, or when we're sort of, when we've had a mix up or a slip up of any variety in our lives, where we engage in this kind of self-lacerating, really kind of abusive talk to ourselves. And I found that meditation, which is just a process of, you know, getting distracted and starting again, getting distracted and starting again, can really help you train up a kind of self-talk that is less negative. Just noticing, oh yeah, so what? I got distracted. No big deal. Nothing's been lost. Let's just start again. And having a kind of inner congeniality can really boost your resiliency when you're faced with all sorts of challenges, whether you've made, you know, manufactured them yourself, or they're imposed upon you by the world. For me, that kind of makes my inner weather a little more balmy.
I like the way you put that. But Dan, before you leave, there is also the 10% Happier app, right? I like the name. Nice and easy to remember.
Yeah, I try. Yeah, brand continuity. The app is a bit, you know, the app is something I really am focused on. It's just a great way for people to learn how to meditate, and you can download it and get started for free.
The book is called 10% Happier, Meditation for Fidgety Skeptics, written by Dan Harris, co-anchor of ABC's Nightline and the weekend editions of Good Morning America. Thanks again, Dan, for joining me in this edition of Chats with Gigi. Make sure to follow online to stay updated with upcoming episodes at Gigi Diaz Live. Chat with you next week.